Good evening. If you would turn to Mark chapter 6, we're going to read the account of the beheading of John the Baptist to establish the basis for our study this evening. This is Mark chapter 6. We'll begin reading in verse 14. Now King Herod heard of him, that is of Jesus, for his name had become well known, and he said, John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him. Others said, it is Elijah, and others said, it is the prophet, or like one of the prophets. But when Herod heard, he said, this is John, whom I beheaded. He has been raised from the dead. For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. Because John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Therefore Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him, but she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. Then an opportune day came when Herod on his birthday gave a feast for his nobles, the high officers and the chief men of Galilee. And when Herodias' daughter herself came in and danced and pleased Herod and those who sat with him, the king said to the girl, ask me whatever you want, and I will give it to you. He also swore to her, whatever you ask me, I will give you up to half my kingdom. So she went out and said to her mother, what shall I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. Immediately she came in with haste to the king and asked, saying, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And the king was exceedingly sorry, yet because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her. Immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought, and he went and beheaded him in prison, brought his head on a platter, and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. When his disciples heard of it, they came and took away his corpse and laid it in a tomb. Thus ends the career of John the Baptist, the forerunner of Jesus the Messiah. What we have here is a little snapshot of a relationship, an adversarial relationship that existed between John the Baptist and Herod. This is Herod Antipas. And this is just one in a long series of kind of adversarial relationships that we see between men of God and men of power. You think of Moses standing before Pharaoh, or Elijah confronting Ahab, or Nathan coming before King David and telling him, thou art the man. And there are any number of examples like this that we could point to in the Bible, and John the Baptist just carries that tradition on. He is a man of God, without fear or favor, telling a man sitting on a throne what the truth is. And even if it's going to cost him his head, it doesn't matter. This man needs to hear it. And so that's what John the Baptist does, and indeed he loses his life because of it. What I'd like for us to do this evening is to engage in a study, a more in-depth study, of just the two men who are involved in this account that we've read here. On the one hand, John the Baptist, the prophet of God, and on the other hand, King Herod Antipas. And look at these two men and draw some comparisons between them, more like contrast, and then, of course, draw some lessons for us today. Let's spend some time talking about the backgrounds of these two men that play such a crucial role in this story. First of all, let's talk about Herod. As I said, this is Herod Antipas. There are all these Herods in the Bible, and you get them all mixed up. They're pretty hard to keep track of. But this man is a son, one of the sons, of Herod the Great. And Herod the Great, of course, is the one who had killed all the little male babies in Bethlehem when Jesus was born. Well, this is his son, one of his sons. And, of course, as the text says here, he was something of a lowlife himself, having stolen his brother's wife. And there are other things we'll get into later. But obviously, he was not the best character around. So he comes from a distinguished family, and historical records tell us that this man, Herod, was actually raised in Rome. Now the family was Idumean. They were actually distant descendants of the Edomites and kind of half-breed Jews. Nominally, they consider themselves to be Jews, the Herod family, and because by hook or crook and all the political machinations that went on in past history, they ruled the Jewish people, and in order to try to ingratiate themselves with their subjects, they became Jews. But of course, it was in name only. They weren't really sincere about it. But suffice it to say, the Herod family, including this man here, saw it as their role in life was to rule over the Jewish people. But this man was raised in Rome, and there in Rome, of course, he had access to all kinds of things that would befitting a man of his rank. He had money, he had power, he had connections with a lot of the Roman officials and people in, high up in government. He became very skilled in the arts of political intrigue. He knew how to get things done. Even if it meant stepping on some toes and leaving a few corpses in your path, you know, that's just the price you pay for getting things done. He learned his lessons well, and he was eventually awarded the position of Tetrarch of Galilee. Now, the Romans had a number of different political positions, and I won't go through trying to define all these things, but suffice it to say, he was the ruler of the area of Galilee where Jesus spent a great deal of his ministry. And in fact, this is the Herod that on one occasion Jesus said concerning him, go tell that fox. He called Herod a fox. Well, this is that man. And in fact, here on this occasion, it is the news of Jesus that has Herod somewhat alarmed. He is afraid that this John the Baptist that he had killed some time earlier has in fact come back from the dead. So far as Herod's character was concerned, he was your typical scheming politician. His role in life was to try to please everybody a little bit, but most of all himself. And whatever it took to play one side against the other and keep all these competing factions in play, just as long as it kept him in power, that's what it took, and that's what he was willing to do. So compromise was the name of the game. Just go along to get along, and whatever it took to maintain the status quo, keep everybody happy, that's what Herod was going to do as long as it kept him in office. And you see a lot of that in the passage that we've read right here. Look, for example, again at verse 17. We're told that he had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. Now, why did he have John in prison? It was because, or for the sake of, Herodias, his wife. And that tells you the influence that Herodias had over her husband to put John in prison. So clearly, this man feared his wife, but he also feared John himself. In verse 20, Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man. So on the one hand, he's afraid of his wife. On the other hand, he's afraid of John. And what are you going to do? How can you reconcile those two competing fears? Well, as obviously the story plays out, Herodias had her druthers. She wanted John the Baptist dead, no question about it. But Herod was not willing to go that far, and so the compromise was, let's throw him in prison. And so that's why John the Baptist ends up in prison. But notice also in verse 26, after he's made this foolish vow to Herodias' daughter, the king was exceedingly sorry, yet because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her. So now he's afraid of his guest. He doesn't want to look bad in front of them. But there's one other passage, too, that adds a little bit additional information to this. Turn to Matthew chapter 14 and verse 5, where we are told that he wanted to put John to death, but he feared the multitude because they counted him as a prophet. So Matthew throws in a little tidbit here that Mark doesn't mention. Not only was he afraid of Herodias and afraid of John and afraid of the guest, he was afraid of the multitude. They thought John the Baptist was a prophet, and if he were to put John the Baptist to death, he'd have an uproar in his hands, and he didn't want that. That, you know, would upset the status quo. So here you have the typical politician who's trying to please everybody. And that's impossible. You can't do that, but that doesn't keep a politician from trying. And this is the way that Herod is trying to keep all the people in his life happy. Now let's turn our attention to John the Baptist. Of course, John was the one who was appointed by God to be the one who is to come in the spirit and power of Elijah as a forerunner to the Messiah. He was actually Jesus' cousin, and he was born a few months before Jesus, and he started his ministry before Jesus did, and he was that voice crying out in the wilderness, preparing the way for the coming of the Lord. John was from an obscure Levitical family. We find the story of his birth in Luke chapter 1. We won't take the time to go through and read the whole story. We are introduced to his parents, Zacharias and his wife Elizabeth, and we're told that they were a godly couple. They were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord blameless. This is Luke 1 and verse 6. Clearly they're good people, good decent people, try to do the right thing. You can imagine the environment of the home in which John was raised then, and he took that training and he applied it in his work as a servant of God, as a prophet. But more than simply being a good, decent man who had this task before him, he was also raised as a Nazarite. If you look in Mark chapter 1, we're given this little detail in verse 6. He was clothed with camel's hair and with leather belt around his waist, and he ate locusts and wild honey. It was a pretty Spartan, austere life that the man led. While others had some kind of normalcy in their lives, the families and the homes and all of the cares and burdens of life, John was not burdened with all of that. He was a prophet of God in the truest, oldest sense of the tradition. The things of this world meant nothing to him. All that he was concerned about was the mission that God gave him, and that was to be the forerunner of the Messiah. In John chapter 1 in verse 7, we have John's account of the work that John came to do. If I can turn there. We'll begin reading in verse 6. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness to bear witness of the light that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. So John the Baptist is the one who is to bear witness of the coming of the light, which is the Messiah, Jesus Christ. That was his work. And it took a special man to fulfill that work. And we see the character of John the Baptist throughout the work that he did. First of all, he was not one to be intimidated by power. As we've already seen in our text here, he was not at all bashful about standing up before a king and criticizing him, rebuking him because of sin in his life. But you get a taste of the kind of man that he was. Look in Luke chapter 3. And this is a unique account that we are given, only Luke describes it, of a snippet of the kind of preaching that he was doing to the people of his day. This was part of preparing the way for the Messiah. We'll begin reading in Luke chapter 3 and verse 7. He said to the multitudes that came out to be baptized by him, "Brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Therefore bear fruits worthy of repentance, and do not begin to say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham as our father.' For I say to you that God is able to raise up children to Abraham from these stones. And even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Therefore every tree which does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire." So the people ask him, saying, What shall we do then?" He answered and said to them, "He who has two tunics, let him give to him who has none, and he who has food, let him do likewise." Then tax collectors also came to be baptized, and he said to him, "Teacher, what shall we do?" And he said to them, "Collect no more than what is appointed for you." Likewise the soldiers asked him, saying, "And what shall we do?" So he said to them, "Do not intimidate anyone or accuse falsely, and be content with your wages." And then he goes on talking about the coming of the Christ. Now, the thing that I want us to understand here is that for every one of these groups of people that came to John the Baptist, there was all this excitement about John, the message that he was preaching. They all came to him saying, "What shall we do?" It would have been very easy for John to tell these people soft and pleasing and pleasant things, tickle their ears, make them feel good, but he didn't do any of that. Each one of these groups of people had certain, we'll call it types of sin or problems or temptations that were unique to them. And John targeted those things. And he told them specifically what they needed to hear to get their rights, their lives right with God. Now, not everything, but just some things that were really unique and personal and meaningful to them. This is what it meant to repent. And this was basically his message to this, to all these folks. You need to turn your lives around. You need to get right with God. And that's what it meant to prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah. These people needed to be prepared to recognize, hey, the kingdom of God is coming. You need to be ready for it. And that means you need to make some changes in your lives. And so he's telling these people specifically what it is they need to do. You can't help but appreciate the courage that it took John to do that. But he didn't stop with just these common people and tax collectors and soldiers coming up to him, asking him what to do. He went straight to the top. As we'll talk in a little bit, he even confronted Herod Antipas, the king, and told him what he needed to do to change his life. But there is, before we leave John's character, there's one other thing I'd like for us to note about him, what made him such a unique character. He was a courageous man, there's no doubt about it. He had no problems standing up to anybody, looking them straight in the eyeball and say, this is what you've got to do. But John was not the sort of person that let that kind of bold courage go to his head and become arrogant about it. Maybe you've known people like that. They have no problem in telling others right and wrong, but it tends to go to their head and they get a little cocky about it. That was not John the Baptist. In fact, if you look back in John chapter 3, in verse 25, we're told there arose a dispute between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purification. Now, this occurred shortly after Jesus began his ministry, and a lot of disciples were beginning to flock to Jesus. And so some of the disciples of John are kind of upset about that. And they come to John in verse 26 and say to him, Rabbi, he who was with you beyond the Jordan to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing and all are coming to him. There's a little bit of jealousy going on here. They don't like the fact that all these crowds are flocking to Jesus now and basically robbing John of his following. So they're a little upset about that. And look at John's response in verse 27. John answered and said, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. And notice verse 30. He, speaking of Jesus, he must increase, but I must decrease. John knew what his role was in God's big plan. He was not the top dog. He was not the big banana here. He was just simply a forerunner. He was the friend of the bridegroom. Jesus was the bridegroom. He was the one that was to get all, ultimately, to get all the attention, all the honor, all the glory. That was his role. John was just to prepare the way for him. And John was okay with that. He carried no undue pride about the work that he was doing. It did not bother him in the slightest that over time his disciples were going to dwindle in number and they were all going to start following Jesus. That was the way it was supposed to be. And John was okay with that. He didn't have a lot of his ego invested in the work that he was doing. All of this was for God and for God's cause, for God's kingdom. And John was more than willing to sacrifice himself, step aside, let somebody else, whatever it took. This was God's show to run, and John was okay with that. You know, that says an awful lot about a man's character when he's willing to maintain that kind of humility alongside the courage that he showed and his willingness to confront people with their sin. But let's get back now to him confronting Herod. This was the big one. This was the one that really spelled his doom. At some point along the way, John confronted Herod. Now, we're not told the details of exactly when or how this occurred. Did Herod call for John to come to him, to hear him? We know that Herod did that for Jesus. Or did John seek him out? Did he go out of his way to somehow get this message to Herod about this sin that he had committed? We really aren't told the details of how they got together and how this message was communicated, but suffice it to say, somehow John the Baptist saw to it that Herod got confronted with his sin. Look in Matthew chapter 14, verses 3 and 4. Matthew's account says that Herod had laid hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John said to him, "It is not lawful for you to have her." But actually, when you look at Luke's account in Luke chapter 3 and verses 19 and 20, find out that it wasn't just the marriage that Herod had John the Baptist had a problem with. Luke's account says that Herod was rebuked by him concerning Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, and for all the evils which Herod had done. And no doubt they were many. So it wasn't just the marriage that was a problem, although that would have been enough. It was the fact that there was all the other chicanery that Herod was involved in as a self-serving politician that needed to be confronted. And John was going to do that. You know, it's one thing for a man to, shall we say, pick on somebody his own size, go after the small fry, go criticize somebody, rebuke somebody, take on somebody that can't fight back. You know, a lot of these other people that John the Baptist had been criticizing or confronting about their sin were people that really couldn't do anything in return to him. That's courageous enough, I suppose. But when you're standing before a king, somebody like this who has the power of life and death in his hand, and he can just snap his finger and you're gone. When you're standing before somebody like that and confronting them with their sins and their mistakes and calling them out, I tell you, that takes a different kind of courage, doesn't it? And that's what John the Baptist had here on this occasion. A passage that we started out with in Mark's account, in Mark chapter 6, Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him. Mark is very specific about it. If she had her way, he would have been dead long before now. Herod didn't like it that he was calling him out on his sins, but Herodias sure didn't like it, and just like Jezebel many years before, was determined to eliminate John as a threat. Now let me address here very quickly something that I'm sure you've noticed in Mark's account of what happened here. The fact that we have John, or Herod, wanting to put John to death, or actually not wanting to put John to death, but yet turning around and putting him to death. Now, obviously, Herodias had something to do with this. How can John play both sides here? How can he want to put John to death and not want to put John to death? Let me put it to you as delicately as I can. Herod did not have to live with John the Baptist. He had to live with Herodias. Right? So I have no doubt in my mind that if Herod could have done what he wanted to do, he would have probably kept John the Baptist in prison indefinitely. We're told in Mark's account that in fact he feared John the Baptist and knew that he was a just and holy man and in fact protected him. When he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. I have no idea what might have happened if John had had the opportunity and the time to continue to talk to Herod. Maybe he could have turned this man around. Of course, we'll never know. Herod may have feared John, but he feared his wife more. And for that reason, when push came to shove, he did what he felt like he had to do to eliminate the threat. And that's how John the Baptist came to meet his untimely end. He served out his purpose. He did the work that God had sent him to do, and then he was gone. And Jesus had to carry on the work without him. Now let's look briefly at the outcome of all of this. Short term, of course, the outcome was pretty obvious. John's courage cost him his life. And that's a sad thing. There's no question about it. Herod got rid of his problem. But did he really? When you follow the career of Herod on, it really doesn't look very pretty. In fact, right here in this context, you know, why are we told this story of Herod executing John the Baptist? What introduces the story is the fact that now Herod is hearing of Jesus and the work that he is doing, and Herod is terrified that John the Baptist has come back from the dead. That is a guilty conscience talking. Herod knew that what he did was wrong. There was no question in his mind about it. And now that Jesus is coming along and he's hearing the miracles and all the things that this man is doing, the crowds flocking after him, it's like deja vu all over again. You know, Herod says, I've seen this before. And this must be John the Baptist that has come back from the dead. It's not just that there was somebody else like John the Baptist, which in fact it was. He actually thinks it's John the Baptist himself that's come back. Now, there's only one reason that a man would come to some kind of irrational conclusion like that, and that is his conscience. I mean, there's some kind of a terrifying fear that has consumed this man to have him come to that kind of a conclusion. Eventually, Herod Antipas got in trouble with the emperor Caligula and was exiled to Gaul, which is modern-day France, and died in disgrace. He came to a worthless end because he had no ground to stand upon. I mean, here's a man that feared everybody, tried to please everybody, and ended up costing him everything. Long term, however, look at these two men. How many parents do you know of today name their kids, their boys, Herod? I haven't heard of a one. But John is a very common name. Parents are more than proud to name their kids John. Because John is remembered, even 2,000 years later, as a hero. Even in the New Testament, as you read on into the book of Acts, long after John was gone, you still encounter disciples of John, people who admire this man and what he taught and what he stood for, and tried to carry on his work. Read of them well into Acts chapter 19 and beyond. And these are people that were scattered all across the Roman Empire, not just a little isolated group in Judea. So John's work, suffice it to say, outlived him long after he was gone. There were still people who were following John and holding him up as a hero. And even today, we of course are not disciples of John the Baptist, but of the one that he foreshadowed. But we today still look up to John as somebody to admire. There are two lessons that we can learn from this study this evening. The first lesson is that convictions can be costly. In fact, they can cost you your life. And we like to think of heroes as the guys who always get the gal and live happily ever after, but I can assure you it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes being the hero means you're the one that dies first. But is that necessarily a bad thing? Dead or alive, the hero, the person that has the kind of character, the kind of convictions, the kind of courage that John displayed on this occasion and throughout his life, these kind of people are going to have far more impact on the world around them, dead or alive. Whether they're here or not to see it, they're going to have a far greater impact on the world than all the politicians like Herod. That is the kind of character, that is the kind of conviction that causes people to sit up and take notice. They respect that. They are inspired by that. And though we may not be around to see the long-term effects of the courage and the conviction that we show, you can bet that it's going to bear fruit somewhere down the line. Jesus testified concerning John the Baptist, "Among those born of women, there has not risen one greater than John the Baptist." And that's while Jesus was still alive. None greater than John the Baptist. As far as mere mortals are concerned, you have to put him at the top. Somebody that we should look up to and admire and whose example we should emulate. Like most Bible characters, these two men then provide a mirror by which we can examine ourselves. So based on this little study this evening, I would challenge us to look at the two men that we've talked about this evening and ask yourself, which one best typifies me? Am I like John the Baptist, a man who has the courage to speak his convictions without fear or favor, without regard to rank or to outcome or to cost, and do the right thing? Or am I more like Herod, always looking for the politically expedient path, the easy way out, trying to please everybody and get along with everybody and ending up not standing for anything? Which one of those two types do you admire? And more importantly, which one of those two types are you? Let's learn from this lesson and do what we can to follow the path that we know is right and that accomplishes the greatest good, not for ourselves, but for God and His cause. If you're here this evening and you recognize that your life is not right with God, you have an opportunity this evening to make whatever changes or corrections or adjustments need to be made in your life. If you need the prayers of the congregation here, if there's any way that we can help and support you in your desire to do what is right, won't you come forward and express your need as together we stand and sing.
Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling, calling for you and for me. See,
Jesus is calling. of those who need to take the Lord's Supper. If you remain standing while the rest are seated, you'll be served.